It's really a pleasure to be here, and so I'd like to thank everyone for coming today and for your invitation to give this talk. And so what I'd like to talk today is about some new developments in neutrino physics and what they may have to say about the matter-antimatter asymmetry of the universe. So over the last few years, you might have noticed some headlines like this. I took this one from this particularly prestigious online source of media because it was particularly egregious in its claims, but basically I'll try to explain what's going on here, what it is about that we have learned about neutrinos that has to do with the matter-antimatter asymmetry of the universe. So it's the key to life, so it won't elucidate anything about personal relationships or dating or anything like that. It's really concentrated on physics, so I hope you weren't having any expectations of that sort. So I'm going to take a bit of a detour at the risk of taking up some time and go back to around 1930, which was a particularly sort of exciting period for physics in general. And so what we call particle physics was sort of, well, particle physics didn't really exist then, but if such a thing existed, it was really simple. Basically, there were protons and electrons, and somehow these things came together through the electromagnetic interactions to form atoms. And basically, you could explain a lot of, basically all this material around that we could see. And then around that time, really a few developments then completely disrupted this picture. And so this is one of the really simple pictures that rose at this time when people were struggling with things like quantum mechanics. But this was sort of near and dear to these people because it was sort of the one simple thing that they could extract from all the things that were going on. So the first thing that sort of disrupted this picture was the discovery of antimatter. And so in particular, this picture shows, so here, a particle which looks just like an electron, but it has a positive charge based on the way it's curving within this magnetic field. And almost coincidentally, at the same time, Dirac was this was basically the second attempt to combine Schrodinger's equation with special relativity, and I stumbled across this equation. And as you probably know, this requires sort of this four-component spinner, which predicts the existence of precisely that kind of particle when you're trying to explain the electron. And so so two things sort of came together there. First, basically, we, in some sense, doubled the number of particles we knew in the universe. And at the same time, we could also sort of fit in within this picture of special relativity and quantum mechanics. Maybe a bit more troubling was the neutron and neutrino. And so you probably may have heard of this famous Dear Radioactive Ladies and Gentlemen letter, in which Pauli basically was trying to solve two outstanding issues in our understanding of what was then nuclear physics. First, it was the issue of this nuclear spin statistics. And so based on our understanding of what the nucleus was at the same time, we were finding that certain nuclei came out with the wrong spin. And then there was another issue where in studying beta decay, basically, if we try to understand it in terms of the particles we knew of, basically the nuclei and electron, this decay should be a two-body process where the kinematics are completely constrained and basically you have a fixed momentum for the outgoing electron. But instead, we saw something like this, a continuous spectrum which leads up to sort of a kinematic endpoint where you would expect the momentum to be for a two-body decay. And so he sort of tried to solve two things at once, and he said that there must be a new neutral particle that we don't know of that is somehow bound within the nucleus with the protons to fix this issue, and also is emitted within the beta decay to basically give you a three-body decay that allows you to have this continuous decay spectrum. So Pauli himself really, if you look, didn't like this idea. And within the letter itself, he calls it a desperate remedy. And so I think the idea was that he was really complicating things by introducing these new particles, or if you saw one particle, but in fact there were two particles, and not explained very much with it. And some people like Bohr said that, well, instead of adding these particles, maybe we just don't understand what's going on, and maybe things like energy conservation don't hold within the nucleus. Now, as it turns out, the issue of the neutron, right, this particle that's actually bound within the nucleus, sorted itself out relatively quickly and was discovered within a few years. Once this idea came out, Fermi, sort of developed a theory of this, of these interactions involving beta decay, in which he could relate the decay rate beta decays to the expected interaction rate for this new particle, the neutrino, that's being emitted. And it became that the cross section was very small, and so small that basically, at least at that time, Pauli really despaired that maybe this particle which may or may not exist, would never be detected, and so you could never really know that such a thing existed. And well, it's interesting to note that how troubled he was with this, because he actually had a sort of a psychological breakdown at this time, and started seeing the famous psychologist Carl Jung. And so I don't know whether it had anything to do with how disturbed he was with this, but it was clear that he was not too happy with this idea. I forgot that I could just push this button like that. Okay, so that was another development. And then the third development was trying to explain how the nucleus basically stays together. So you know that there are neutrons and protons now in this nucleus, and how is it that they manage to stay together? And so it was Yukawa who sort of made this observation that basically a leap in which he could observe that the interaction must be short range because it only exists within the finite, well, within the extent of the nucleus, and somehow he could relate that range to the mass of the particle, the mediator, that which must be responsible for this new force. And so based on that, he could basically predict, conjecture what the mass of this force-carrying partner should be. And so he predicted that it should be around 200 times the mass of the electron based on the typical size of the nucleus. And well, if you know your numbers, that points to something around 100 MeV. And sure enough, there was a particle discovered with that mass, what we now call the muon, which has about 106 MeV of mass, but it doesn't interact strongly. And so that was it basically had the right mass, but basically the wrong features to explain the nuclear dynamics, that it was supposed to be, to basically fulfill the role that it was supposed to have in holding the nucleus together. And as we know now, basically nature had played a trick on us and put forth an imposter, this muon, which was not strongly interacting, but which had a very similar mass to the pion. And then the pion was basically discovered later. It took a few decades to sort out this picture. So, so there they were, just all these new particles appearing. And so what was maybe special about the muon was that these other particles, particularly the positron and the pion, they sort of had some early warning that you knew from Dirac that something had to be done with this issue about this four-component spinner. You knew it from nuclear that something must be happening within the nucleus, which is holding it together. So maybe it wasn't too surprising that we discovered new particles there. But the muon really came out of nowhere. And so sort of led to this famous quip from Isidore Rabia, you know, who ordered that? You know, why does such a particle exist? And also in trying to understand the antimatter, there came this issue that basically the matter and the antimatter were really on equal footing. And so one interesting thing was that one of the early ideas when they were considering this anti-electron was that, well, maybe the anti-electron, which is positively charged, is a proton. So this once again just sort of reflects the conservatism that was in that time against introducing new particles, but it was quickly found that that just didn't work. But basically, they find that the matter and antimatter, at least in terms of the way they're produced and also their underlying theory, they were really on the equivalent footing. And so how is it that we came to this matter-dominated universe where antimatter becomes sort of this exotica? And so maybe a second question that came out of this era was, where did this matter-antimatter come from and where did it go such that our universe is all matter-dominated now? What was one era, and then with the advent of sort of studying cosmic rays, further studies of cosmic rays, as well as particularly accelerators, there was basically sort of an explosion of particles that we just discovered all sorts of things. And well, of course, one of the things that was discovered, this is a telegram to Pauli from Reines and Cohen. So happily for Pauli, in the 1950s, they actually identified the neutrino, or actually what we now call the antineutrino, and so he could sort of rest peacefully with that. But even by the end of the 50s, people were really troubled with this picture again, that it was nice to discover all these pictures, but somehow, rather these particles, but how do they all fit together? And even by the mid-50s, in his Nobel Prize speech, William Willis Lamb basically said that it's really troubling. Hopefully we don't discover any more because it's just sort of complicating this picture. So then if we sort of fast forward to where we are now and what we now call the Standard Model, so a lot of that within the 70s, there was sort of an enormous synthesis of both sort of a taxonomic issue of sorting out what all these particles are, and also sort of a dynamic revolution where basically we came to view gauge quantum field theory as sort of the basis of the fundamental interactions. And so when all that sort of was passed, we had this beautiful picture of quarks which come together and form things like the pions, in quark and anti-quark pairs, or form things like protons and neutrons in triplet combinations. So these are strongly interacting particles, and then there are these weakly interacting particles like the electron, muon, and tau, and their corresponding neutrinos, and then, of course, their corresponding antiparticles. And then we can basically explain their interactions through a set of mediators, whether it's the photon for the electromagnetic force, the W and Z for the weak interaction, and so on and so forth. But if you look at this picture, you basically are still left with this question. We added more particles, and we sort of boiled it back down to what we think is the essence of all these other particles. But instead of asking why there's a muon, we can ask why are there suddenly three generations of particles? And also, what distinguishes the particles up here, the matter, from the particles down here, the antimatter? So with that, let me turn to the weak interactions. And so maybe we can find some clues there. And so the weak interaction basically comes in two forms. There's the charge current interaction, this W. And so within the standard model, what that basically allows you to do is go up and down between this top row and the bottom row for the quarks, or likewise for the leptons. And so basically a U quark can become a down type quark, or vice versa. And then there's this neutral current process where basically the particle maintains its identity, much in the way that when you have some kind of Coulomb interaction between two charged particles, the identity of the particles stays the same, but basically a force is exchanged between them. And that's not a coincidence, because as we understand it now, the Z has a very intimate connection to the photon. And so based on that, we could explain things like beta decay as a transition between the neutron and the proton, where a down quark becomes an up quark via this charge-current interaction. And you can sort of see the universality in this. And like, for example, in the muon decay, basically instead of the down quark, we have the muon transitioning into a muon neutrino. So the situation is a little bit more complicated than that, because we have these three generations. And so what happens is that basically we can also cross generations. So instead of just going up and down, we can go across, or even across two generations like this. And the way we understand this now is that what actually couples to the up quark, which we call the down prime, D prime, or the down prime quark, is a linear combination of these other quarks down here. And in particular, that relationship is expressed by this matrix, which we now call the Kibibo Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix, or a mixing matrix. And so basically, it's a bunch of numbers which are constrained by unitarity to relate the mass eigenstates to the flavor eigenstates. And with this, we could understand such properties of the weak interaction like this one here. So there's a particular particle called the D plus meson, and it can decay into, let's say, a kaon and a pion, or a pion, or two pions. And so here you can see that there's a charm to strange transition involved. And so the W, if you look at that element here, it's close to one. So basically that kind of transition is favored within this model. And one way to think about that is that it stays within a generation. But then coupling like this one, which involves a charm to down transition, you see the number is smaller. And actually the rate is basically governed by the squares of these numbers. And so when we look at how often this kind of decay happens as opposed to that one decay happening, you see that this one is much smaller because it's suppressed by this factor. And this is what we call the CKM suppression or rates. So that's in the quark sector. If we turn to the neutrino sector, exactly the same thing happens. We have these flavor eigenstates. Basically, let's say there's electron, muon, and tau, and there's a neutrino associated with each one of them. And so when an electron neutrino interacts, it produces an electron. Or likewise, when a pion decays to produce a muon, it's a muon neutrino which accompanies it. But like in the quark sector, at least what we call flavor eigenstates are linear combinations of the mass eigenstates. And so there's non-zero probability that a neutrino produced in one flavor can be detected in a different flavor after some propagation in space-time. And it's basically given this by this formula here in vacuum, if there's no matter. It looks like a relatively complicated equation, but basically what it comes down to is that this probability that you start off with a neutrino type alpha and detected as a neutrino type beta, you have this amplitude, which is basically determined by the elements of this mixing matrix. And then you have the sinusoidal dependence, where basically the argument of the sign is the distance the neutrino travels divided by its energy. And then it's basically the wavelength within this argument is determined by the eigenvalues of the mass squared, and there are differences in particular. Okay? And so one way to detect these neutrino oscillations is let's say we start with some neutrino beam of a certain neutrino type. There is some probability after some distance that it acquires a component of a different flavor. And so if we actually measure those, look at those neutrino interactions, well, we should either find that the amount of initial flavor, let's say if we started with muon neutrinos, well, if some of them turn into some other flavor, then there'll be a deficit of that initial flavor. So there'll be fewer muon neutrinos after some distance. The other way you can detect it is that, well, if they turn into a different flavor, then we should be able to detect that new flavor. And so if you find neutrinos appearing in your beam of a different flavor that weren't there at the beginning, then you know that this is also an indication of neutrino oscillations. Okay? And so basically the spectrum of this basically reflects the oscillation probability. And so where the oscillation probability is maximum reflects basically the mass square differences of the mass eigenstates involved in the oscillation. And the amplitudes in turn reflect the matrix elements of this mixing matrix. So if we restrict ourselves to the three neutrinos that we know exist now, we basically can parameterize this 3x3 matrix or decompose it into these three rotations. And basically what the structure here is that you have three 2x2 rotations. So here you have this is supposed to be cosine theta 1,2, sine theta 1,2. And so that's just a two-dimensional rotation in the first and second part of this vector. Then over here you have the second and third part. And then here you have sort of the cross term, the 1,3, mixing up the first and third row and column. And so associated with each of these rotations is an angle. Here is theta 1,2, theta 1,3, and theta 2,3. And then furthermore, here there's also this basically this complex phase, which changes sign under when you consider neutrinos as opposed to antineutrinos. And so within this picture, if we take sort of the world's knowledge of neutrino data right now, what we find now is that this matrix sort of looks like this. And if you turn, that's in terms of this parameterization there, but if you express it in terms of these angles, we now know that this theta 1,2 over here is relatively large, about 33.6 degrees. One of the recent developments is that this theta 1,3, this guy here, is non-zero. And that's actually not zero, but rather 0.15. And that this theta 2,3 over here is basically at its maximal value, 45 degrees, which reflects the maximum rotation between flavor and mass eigenstates. So that's on the matrix element side. We also need to know about the masses to tell us what the wavelength of these oscillations are. And so we basically know that there's sort of a small splitting of around 8 times 10 to the minus 5 eV squared. And sometimes this is called the solar splitting because it was basically responsible for the solar neutrino anomaly. And then we have a larger splitting around 2.4 10 to the minus 3, which corresponds to what we call the atmospheric splitting, which is because the neutrino oscillations discovered by atmospheric neutrinos are basically driven by this splitting. And so what you see here is that there are two characteristic lengths over which the neutrino oscillations can occur. And depending on where you put your detector and the energy of the beam you have, you can basically separate out the oscillations from one regime or the other. Okay? And so we'll be mainly focusing on this one here, where basically the maximum of the oscillation happens at 500 kilometers per GeV, which means that if you have a 1 GeV neutrino, the oscillation effect is, the amplitude of the oscillation is maximum at 500 kilometers. Okay, so in terms of, what do we have to do here? So in terms of the big pictures in particle physics, one of the issues is that if you compare what we have with the quark mixing matrix here, and compare it with the lepton mixing matrix, you see that they're really, really different, right? This has sort of this near diagonal term, which sort of, there's sort of almost like a monogamous relationship between the up and down quark, the charm and strange quark, and then there's sort of a little bit of promiscuity where it sort of goes over into the other generations. Whereas somehow the neutrinos are completely anarchic and they just partner with whatever flavor or mass eigenstate they want. So why are these two things so different, especially given that the mathematical structures are pretty much the same? Then there's also this issue where if we look at the masses of the particles, we see that the neutrinos are really far separated from all these other particles. And so even things like the electron, which are the lightest other known particle at half an MeV, there are a few orders of magnitude, or several orders of magnitude, which separate the mass of the electron from a neutrino. And so some of the questions that you can ask are, what really explains these numbers? And is there any relationship between this and that, and in this and that? Particularly the masses versus the mixing, and the mixing in the two types of particles. And so in terms of neutrino oscillations on the experimental side, what we can do is try to improve the precision of these things. One thing I forgot to mention was that our current understanding of the masses basically gives us two solutions. All we know is the splitting between these, the relative differences in the masses, And so we know there's a small one and a big one, but that can be arranged in two ways. And so this is what we call the mass hierarchy problem. This is we call the normal hierarchy, and this one we call the inverted hierarchy, based on whether the pattern looks like what we've seen in the quarks or the opposite of that. And so another question is that we should resolve this mass hierarchy to understand better the structure of masses within the neutrinos. And then the next thing, which I'll talk more about, is the search for CP violation, which is basically a difference between the oscillation probabilities, properties of neutrinos and antineutrinos. And so for me, we had this question about why there is a muon, which you sort of translated into why are there three generations. But now that we have three generations of particles, we can basically be asking a more specific question: what endows these, what gives these particles their particular properties in terms of their mixing and masses? And in some sense, it's basically the same question that is more precisely asked in the context of the parameters that we know that exist within this theory. So now coming to the matter-antimatter asymmetry of the universe, and in particular, what I'll call the primordial asymmetry, why there is just more matter and antimatter in the universe. It was actually Sakharov maybe in the 60s, who basically laid out the formula or the necessary conditions for this to happen in the early universe. In retrospect, maybe the first two are a little bit obvious. So the first thing is that there must be some baryon number non-conservation. So if the universe starts off with a baryon equals zero state, and suddenly we have lots of baryons, then somewhere a baryon symmetry must have been broken. Another one is charge and CP symmetry violation. And that basically comes down to the fact that somewhere there must be a difference between some process and its corresponding antiparticle process. And this is basically what allows us to prefer matter and antimatter or in one way or the other. And so some kind of CP violation must exist in order for us to push that imbalance. And maybe the less, at least from the particle physics perspective, the less obvious one is this departure from thermal equilibrium. And so if everything is happening within thermal equilibrium, you can have all these processes happening, but basically the reverse processes can happen as well. And then any asymmetry that you would produce will get washed out. And so you need to be sort of outside of thermal equilibrium in order to freeze in some kind of asymmetry that you generate in the early universe. So we know more about this primordial antimatter in the universe. And there was this recent article on Slate. And in terms of trying to make friends outside the community, it's great that we basically tell people that you're an impurity in an otherwise beautiful universe. And basically, the idea is that basically the balance, even though it's not maybe not so obvious when we look around now, the balance between the matter and antimatter relative to the amount of matter and antimatter we believe existed in the early universe is extremely small. It's extremely fine-tuned. And so basically, the annihilation which occurred, it was perfect to the level of something like 1 part in 10 to the 10 billion. And that 1 10 billionth that's left is basically the matter that exists in the universe and everything that we see. And so really the challenge now is how do we qualitatively understand that number and explain it in terms of both the particle physics and the cosmology that we know. Now, we raise two questions now. Where did this primordial asymmetry come from? And then why are there these three generations of particles and what determines their properties in terms of masses and mixing? And one connection actually came from these two gentlemen here, Kobayashi and Maskawa, and they basically observed that if you wanted to have CP violation within the weak interaction through this mixing, in other words, if you wanted to have some kind of quark or anti-quark difference or a neutrino or anti-neutrino difference through that mechanism, you need to have at least three generations of particles. If you have two, then basically there are not enough degrees of freedom to support a complex phase which will actually induce a matter-antimatter or CP violating effect. And so there was sort of one hint there as to why there might be three generations. So now we saw that the CP violation itself is also a necessary ingredient to generate this primordial asymmetry, as pointed out by Sakharov. So then you ask the question, well, let's say we have the CP violation in quarks, which we now firmly observe and is very consistent with what they had expected. Is that, in fact, the CP violation that will give us this primordial asymmetry and in particular give us this sort of 1 part in 10 billion cancellation? And as it turns out, the answer is no. It fails to produce the asymmetry by many orders of magnitude. So the CP violating effect there, as we understand it now, is too weak. Now, the same thinking happened in the lepton sector with neutrinos, because now there are three generations of neutrinos. And so you can say, well, we haven't found CP violation in neutrinos yet, could that be responsible? And the answer, as it turns out, is no also. But there is a twist to this, and which I'll try to explain next. And this is the theory of leptogenesis. And it stems from one difference between the neutrinos and the rest of the particles, which is that there are basically two possible natures to the neutrino. It could have a Dirac nature, where it basically is like any other fermion in the standard model, like the quark or the electron, where the neutrino and antineutrino are actually distinct species of particles. However, because of its neutral nature, there's also a second possibility where the neutrino is in fact self-conjugate. It's its own antiparticle. And in particular, it can actually have sort of a joint nature where it has masses associated with both of these natures. And so if we had such a system, and we had construct some kind of mass matrix and diagonalize it, it's been observed for a while that there's this so-called seesaw effect. The sum of the degrees of freedom are pushed towards lower masses, while others get pushed towards higher masses according to this relationship here. So we have some Majorana mass term and a Dirac mass term within this original mass matrix. And when you diagonalize that, you find that some of these are suppressed by this Majorana mass, and the other system, other particles end up with masses close to this original Majorana mass, assuming that the Majorana mass is quite a bit larger than the Dirac mass. So if you plug in some numbers that we know, for example, we think that the neutrinos are around 0.01 eV in mass. If we use the, if we look at the other Dirac particles, you know, things like quarks, and we say, well, that seems to be coming from some kind of electroweak scale. So we put in something like 100 GeV. We find that basically this Majorana mass term has to be around 10 to the 15 GeV in order to get the right neutrino mass. And that basically gets transferred over there. And as it turns out, that happens to be where we expect grand unification to occur. And in this model, it's not the CP violation here which creates the primordial asymmetry, or rather the CP violation of these heavy particles in the early universe that induce the asymmetry and then eventually propagate to give us the universe as we know now. And so the hope is, well, within this picture, basically the CP violation here is mathematically related to the CP violation that may happen here. And so if we observe something here, we may be able to infer something about what happened over there. Now, that statement is very much stronger than it should be, because we actually do not know at all how to connect those two things. But in principle, they are connected. So with that, let me turn to neutrino oscillations. And one of the recent developments which is associated with CP violation is that we are moving away from what we call the two-flavor error. And so in the past era, effectively something like last year, we could basically work with relatively simple formulas for neutrino oscillations. So if we wanted to look at the disappearance of muon neutrinos, basically the deficit of muon neutrinos at the atmospheric scale resulting from their transformation into muon or electron or tau neutrinos, you could basically express that with a simple formula here. So you see there's a sine squared 2 theta 2 3, the amplitude of the oscillation, and then this basically wavelength term, the kinematic term. And so that's a very simple thing. If you measure muon neutrino disappearance, you're basically measuring 2 theta 2 3 of this mixing matrix. Likewise, electron neutrino appearance. So the muon neutrinos are transforming into electrons or tau neutrinos. And so if we wanted to know how many are turning into electron neutrinos, we could effectively simplify this expression as follows. So you see there's a sine squared theta 2, 3. There's a sine squared 2 theta 1, 3. And that basically sets the amplitude. And basically, you have the same kinematic term again. And so now if we leverage what we know about theta 2, 3, which is that it's near maximal, near 45 degrees, that turns out to be about 1/2. And so basically, we can say that this is approximately 1/2 sine squared 2 theta 1 3 times the kinematic term. Okay? But now, two things have happened. We are making much more precise measurements. And so basically, these approximations don't work anymore. A second thing that's happened is that we have a knowledge now that the theta 1 3 is not zero and is, in fact, not even really that small. And so a lot of things before assumed that this term was very small. And so we have to consider corrections that result from theta 1, this fact. And then, because of the increasing precision, there are other things that we have to account for, like the fact that the neutrino oscillations are affected by the matter that they travel through. And so that means that we basically have to go away from the simple picture to a full three-flavor model. Now, unfortunately, that picture is relatively complicated. And even this is basically an approximation of the full three-flavor mixing that occurs in the presence of matter. And there are several forms of this, and this is the simplest one I can find. So let me try to point out some of the key features of this. So first here, you see what we consider the leading order term, right? Sine squared theta 2, 3 sine squared 2 theta 1 3. Here's the kinematic term, right? This delta is basically that kinematic term we had before. But now there's this x in there. And x is basically accounting for the effects of matter as the neutrino goes through there. And that x actually changes sign in two ways. Between neutrinos and antineutrinos, it changes sign. And depending on the sign of delta m squared 3 1, the differences of the mass squared of the eigenvalues, it also changes sign. All right? So then there's these two terms here. And so now you see there's a sine delta and a cosine delta. And so delta was this complex phase that appeared along with theta 1 3. And basically that will change sign between neutrinos and antineutrinos. And so if we put delta to minus delta, this part will change sign if you go from neutrino to antineutrino. And well, this side will stay the same. And so basically we have a CP odd term and a CP conserving term that has appeared. And then finally, you can see that this x is appearing everywhere. And so basically, if we can understand all the other parameters well enough and constrain this thing enough, then we have the possibility of actually resolving the mass hierarchy, since this x will change sign depending on what the mass hierarchy is, whether 3 versus 1 is positive or negative. And then finally, there's this term here, sine squared theta 2, 3. So up until now, we've been talking primarily about 2 times the angle. Well, this is theta 2, 3. And so, for example, when you talk about 2 theta 2, 3, there's sort of a twofold degeneracy, depending on whether the angle is greater than or less than 45 degrees. It doesn't care. But if you're talking about theta 2, 3, then it does matter whether you are greater than 45 degrees or less than 45 degrees. And so there's also the opportunity to study whether this theta 2, 3, which side of 45 degrees it is on, assuming that it's not precisely 45 degrees. So if we look at how this impacts the neutrino oscillation probability, so in our simple model, basically we get this purple line here. In the CP violating term, you can see in this, when you have delta equals pi over 2, 90 degrees, it actually suppresses the oscillation. The CP conserving term is relatively small. And then finally, let's see, there's the matter effect, which comes in from basically turning this x into a non-zero order. And as it turns out, for the experiment that I'll be talking about today, TDK at 295 kilometers, you see that the matter effect is actually very small. And then finally, there's a solar term, which comes from basically even when theta 1, 3 is zero, there's still oscillations occurring because of the solar scale physics, albeit at a very small scale. Okay, so I'll be talking about basically three measurements. Within TDK, this is the new mu disappearance. And basically, this is expanded form of the original formula I showed a few slides ago. And so instead of just having sine squared 2 theta 2, 3, we have this cosine squared 2 theta 1, 3, cosine to the fourth 2 theta 1, 3. And in an area where we might have thought that theta 1, 3 was 0, that would have been precisely 1. Then there's also this additional term where it's not sine squared 2 theta 2, 3, but sine squared theta 2, 3. And so once again, we have this issue about the octant of theta 2, 3, whether it's greater than or less than 45 degrees. So one fortunate thing is that there's actually a pretty good understanding of what sine squared, what theta 1, 3 is. And so we can actually correct for these things. But this one here, we still do not know. Now, this is muon neutrino disappearance. As it turns out, you can also study electron neutrino disappearance with reactor experiments. And this actually gives us a very nice measurement of sine squared 2 theta 1, 3, because basically you can separate out this term from that term because that one is driven by a small mass splitting, and that one is driven by the last large mass splitting. So I'll come back to what role this measurement happens. I already talked about muon. All right, never mind. All right, so let me talk about the TDK experiment. So this experiment basically involves producing a muon neutrino beam with an accelerator complex and sending it 300 kilometers across Japan to see whether neutrino oscillations are happening. And so how do we produce this neutrino beam? We have an accelerator complex from which we extract protons. They're incident on a piece of carbon, which we call a target. And these produce secondary particles like pions and kaons. We have a set of for focusing electromagnetic devices which focus one polarity of the particles, whether it's the positive or the negative particles, into this decay region. And then these particles decay, basically producing the neutrinos that we want to observe. And so the primary particle that gets produced are these pions. And so the beam is primarily muon neutrino. But you can see that these kaon decays and muon decays also produce electron neutrinos. And so in particular, if we're looking for muon neutrino to electron neutrino oscillation, we have to be aware of the fact that there are electron neutrinos in the beam, regardless of whether of any neutrino oscillation effects. So this is another sort of schematic of what the beamline looks like. And here's the accelerator. You pull out the protons, and then here's the target. You have these focusing devices. The decays happen here. You have a beam dump where you basically terminate all the particles except for the neutrinos. And then those neutrinos continue to a near detector and then 295 kilometers to the super K detector. And so for our purposes, the beam is basically peaked at 600 MeV. And so if you remember this 500 kilometers per GeV maximum oscillation, that's basically tuned to precisely that, so that the oscillation effect is maximum at the distance of 295 kilometers. So now in terms of the oscillation strategy, we'll observe these events as super K, and basically what we want to infer is from observing electron neutrinos, we want to learn about theta 1,3 and theta 2,3. By looking at the deficit of muon neutrinos, we want to learn about theta 2,3 and the mass squared splitting. We also have these backgrounds. So basically we need to be able to predict what the detector should observe as a function of these oscillation parameters. And so that basically comes down to this formula here. So there's a flux of neutrinos. They have some cross-section for interacting in your detector. There's some efficiency for your detector to see them or identify them correctly. And then finally, there's the oscillation probability based on the fact that the flavor is changing in the 295 kilometers that it has traversed. So in order to predict the neutrino flux, we basically have a simulation of the beamline where we tune it with all sorts of external data, both in-situ and ex-situ, to predict what kind of pions are produced and what kind of kaons are produced and how they decay to produce what energy particles they produce and what species of neutrinos that they produce. And so you can see here that this black, the muon neutrino, is the dominant component of the beam. The next thing is this cross-section. So for now, we're mainly using historic cross-section information from previous measurements of basically how often neutrinos interact. And so those are combined with these two things to basically tell us what the overall interaction rate is. And then we have a simulation of the far detector where we simulate these interactions in the detector and understand our detector response, and we can simulate the selection criteria that we apply, and then we can basically see how many of these interactions we would actually identify. Now there's an issue because the flux and the cross sections are actually not very precisely known. There's a significant systematic uncertainty on the order of 20-30%. And so one thing we can do is we can place a detector close to the neutrino source before any neutrino oscillations occur, and basically we can observe the same neutrino flux in the same cross sections. And basically, if we understand these efficiencies well enough, then we can cancel a large part of this uncertainty by basically observing the same neutrino beam before and after oscillation effects. And so that's part of the strategy. Just to give you some figures about this, neutrinos are, as you probably know, a very feebly interacting particle. And so, and that's one of the reasons why Pauli really despaired of whether it will ever be observed. And so the interaction, like if you had some kind of very long, you know, cosmic scale lengths of lead, a 1 GeV neutrino would actually have a typical interaction length of something like a light year, just to give you an idea how feeble the interaction is. Whereas for a photon, it's actually on the order of a few millimeters. And so basically, in order to collect a number of events, you basically have three parameters. There's a number of targets on which the neutrinos can interact. There's a cross-section and how many neutrinos that you're producing, the flux of neutrinos. Now, this guy you cannot do anything about because that's just a fundamental property to neutrino. But then these two things are basically governed by how intense a neutrino beam you can produce. And so in our case, we're putting something like 2 times 10 to the 14 protons on the target every 3 seconds in a 5 microsecond burst. And so that's equivalent to sort of a good fraction of a kilogram of TNT on the target. And so one thing that was developed around here, actually at Toronto and York, is a detector which can actually image this beam right before it goes into the target, despite the really harsh radiation environment that results from there. The other part of this is that we want to have as many targets as possible. And so we utilize this enormous detector, Super Kamiokande. And so it's basically a water tank that's 40 meters in diameter and nearly 40 meters in height. And so you can see sort of the people on wraps here to give you a scale of this. And what's perhaps even more astonishing is that you can make a big volume with this ultra pure water, but then there's also these 11,000 photosensors which line the walls of these detector. And as it turns out, these are each sort of hand-blown by two people that work at the Hamamatsu factory. And so apparently they were retiring, so I think there was some kind of internship program to get younger people up to speed on how to do that. So the detection principle is Cherenkov radiation. And basically, this is a form of electromagnetic radiation that occurs when a charged particle exceeds the speed of light within a medium. And so basically, it's going faster than c over n, where n is the index of refraction of that material. And so you can sort of dramatically see that here, where this is sort of a nuclear waste storage facility. It's contained within water, and basically the radiation going out from there is producing relativistic particles, which are in turn inducing Cherenkov radiation and producing this blue glow. You can also see that the Cherenkov effect is sort of nicely encapsulated. This is actually the tomb of Cherenkov in Moscow. And so basically what happens is that this cone of radiation gets emitted along the axis of the direction of motion. And basically, well, for it only happens for relativistic particles. And so for water, where n is 1.33, the minimum velocity that a particle has to have is about 3/4 the speed of light before you start seeing this effect. And the cone, the opening angle of the cone is about 42 degrees once you reach close to the speed of light. So yeah, well, what do we do with that? Well, basically the idea is that the neutrino interactions occurring in the water detector produce these charged particles. They emit Cherenkov radiation. And all these nice photosensors lining the outer periphery of the detector detect that light and tell us something about that particle. And so one thing it can tell us is that, well, based on the amount of light in the ring and also its direction, we can reconstruct the momentum of the particle. Now, there's a further thing we can do. There are minimum ionizing particles like the muon, which basically plow straight through the water and produce a very clean Cherenkov ring pattern. On the other hand, particles like electrons and photons, they induce these electromagnetic showers, like observed here in a bubble chamber. And so basically, they produce many, even though you started off in only one particle, you suddenly have all these other electrons and positrons contributing to the Cherenkov ring. And so they actually produce a more diffuse, fuzzier pattern of Cherenkov radiation. And then you can also reconstruct multiple particles by the fact that, if you will, if there are multiple rings, then presumably different particles produce them. And so this is sort of a way in which we can both reconstruct the kinematics of the part of the interaction and also tell what kind of particles were produced. So in terms of the neutrino interactions at these energies, basically we have two kinds of processes. One is this so-called charge current quasi-elastic process. And so this is sort of the simplest kind of process that can happen at this energy. What basically happens is that a neutrino undergoes this charge current interaction with a neutron and produces a proton and turns into its corresponding lepton. And so this proton, the proton being relatively heavy, nearly like 1 GeV in mass, is usually below Cherenkov threshold. And so what we see in the end is a single ring associated with that lepton. And so if we see a muon-type ring with this sharp edge, we can say that was a muon neutrino. And if it's a sort of a fuzzy pattern, then we can say it was an electron neutrino. And so that's how we can classify what kind of neutrino interactions we're observing at super K. Now, those are the processes that we want. There's a second property of this, where is that this is sort of a quasi-two-body interaction. And since we only see this part of the interaction, what's nice about this is that based on the momentum of this particle, the ring that we observe, we can use the kinematics, the underlying kinematics, to infer what the neutrino energy was. And if you remember, the oscillation probability was also a function of neutrino energy, so it's important to understand that to extract that dependence. Now, those aren't the only kinds of interactions. There's also these pion production channels where we get a more complicated topology. And so one issue is that, for example, when we produce a pi zero through a neutral current process like this, that pi zero decays into two photons, and those two photons actually produce rings that look just like an electron or a photon. And so if we miss one of the rings and we only see one ring, then it basically looks exactly like an electron neutrino interaction. And so that's a dangerous background for us. Now, if we have a charge current interaction where there's also a muon here, then basically we can try to reconstruct multiple rings and reject events where we see more than one ring. Another handle we have is that the pion, if it's a charged pion, may come to rest. It will decay into a muon. And then the muon, a few microseconds later, will decay into an electron. And so we can see that electron. And so if we can see that decay electron appearing a few microseconds after a neutrino interaction, we can infer that there was probably a pion there and reject the event as well, even if we don't explicitly see its Cherenkov ring. All right, so with that, let me show you what the results look like. Well, first, how do we select the muon events? It basically just goes like what I told you. We want to select events that have a single ring, so we count the number of rings, and we take the ones that have a single ring. There's a variable which basically characterizes how sharp the outer edge of this ring is. And so if it's electron-like, it ends up being negative in this parameter. And if it's muon-like with a sharp ring, ends up being positive in this parameter. And so we just get rid of the fuzzy-looking rings. And then there's this decay electron criteria. So I said that the decay electron is an indication of the presence of a pion. Now, in this case, the muon also decays and produces an electron. So we have to allow for the possibility that it produces an electron. So in this case, we allow either 0 or 1 decay electrons, but not 2. And so that allows us to further suppress the CC non-QE, or these events in which there are a pion. So once we select those events, we can look at the neutrino energy. And so this is what we see. So in the absence of oscillations, the energy distribution we expect is this black histogram here. And what we actually observe are these data points here. So you can see there's a real enormous suppression relative to what we expect in the absence of neutrino oscillations. So neutrino oscillations are really dramatically there. The other thing we can do is that we know that the neutrino oscillations are a function of energy. And so we can compare the null oscillation case to the oscillation case and basically take the ratio between these points and the black curve. And so you can see that they line up very nicely with what we expect from neutrino oscillations with nearly maximal mixing. And so based on this data, we can sort of, one other point is that basically this point here, the maximum of the oscillation, or where the deficit is maximum, that points to where the oscillation probability is maximum. And that also gives us basically the mass squared, or the wavelength of the oscillation involved. And so based on that data, we can express the allowed values of sine squared 2 theta 2 3, the amplitude, and delta m squared, the wavelength of the oscillations, by these curves here. And so there's a complication because, as I mentioned before, there's a sine squared theta 2 3 term. And so it depends on whether theta 2 3 is greater than or less than 45 degrees, and which we don't know. And so under the two assumptions, we can make basically these two contours, which within is the allowed parameter range. And so what's nice here is that if you look at the numbers here, the measurements on sine squared 2 theta 2 3 are getting down into the few percent region. And eventually we hope to get down to 1% and really make a precise measurement. And one of the key questions here is that right now the data indicates that we're really at the limit of this, that sine squared 2 theta 2 3 equals 1. And that's a very unusual thing. And it may point to some kind of something happening which actually enforces that value. And so one question is, if we make a really precise measurement, can we actually see whether this parameter is significantly different from 1? So if I now turn to the electron appearance channel, it's effectively the same thing, but there's one twist to this. So instead of, we want single ring events, but last time we threw out the electron-like rings and kept the muon-like rings. So obviously this time we keep the electron-like rings and throw out the muon-like rings. The electron itself will never produce a decay electron. And so if there are any decay electrons associated with it, that probably indicates the presence of a pion. And so we require 0 decay electrons in this case. I told you about this pi 0 background, right? And so there are the cases where, in fact, we reconstruct the two photons. If we take the invariant mass of those two photons, we actually get the pi 0 mass. And so by cutting on this variable, we can reject a considerable number of pi 0 events. And this is actually a new capability that we just added this year. And we can do sort of like almost 3 times better than we did before. And so what we do here is there's two variables which basically quantify how much more pi zero-like it is in an electron and in this mass. And we basically keep the events in this lower left corner. And so the result here is that, in the absence of, with theta 1,3 equal to 0, we would expect something like 4.6 events adding up all the backgrounds. And when we look, we actually observe 28 electron neutrino candidates. So it's a really dramatic signal. And actually the first time any experiment has explicitly seen a new neutrino flavor appearing in a beam of some other neutrino flavor. And so we can really conclusively say that for the first time that we observe this phenomenon, and that in particular that we've seen the neutrino oscillations associated with theta 1,3 not equal to 0. So if we look more in detail, this is the neutrino energy spectrum of those 28 events. What we actually do is analyze the events in terms of the momentum and angle of these electron candidates. And so you can see the expectation in the color histogram and where the data points actually lie. And so it agrees really nicely with the neutrino oscillation hypothesis. So we do the same thing again. We ask what oscillation parameters are allowed. And here it becomes very complicated because there's not only theta 1,3, which is driving the first order oscillation, but then there's also a dependence on the CP violating phase. And then there's also, because of the matter of fact, even though it's small, there's a difference between normal hierarchy and inverted hierarchy. And so we do the analysis in two ways, with mass hierarchy, normal mass hierarchy, and inverted mass hierarchy. And basically, this black curve corresponds to what the allowed regions are, assuming that sine squared theta 2,3 is equal to 0.5. Now we know that that's not such a great assumption, because actually the error on this is something like 20%. And so in the future analyses, we'll have to account for the error in that parameter when we draw this curve. But just to give you an idea of how much that impact that has, if sine squared theta 2,3 is 0.6, we get the green curve, rather the blue curve, and if it's 0.4, we get the green curve. And that just sort of reflects the impact of this 20% uncertainty that we still have in this parameter. And so the idea is to make these more precise mu mu disappearance measurements to improve the constraint on that. So complementary to TDK, there have also been these experiments analyzing antineutrinos from reactor experiments. And so here, basically, we can probe theta 1,3 through the disappearance of electron neutrinos produced by reactors, or electron antineutrinos. And so they also, in 2012, saw a definitive disappearance effect. And so they can measure this theta 1,3 parameter very precisely. And so one big difference here is that they are really measuring theta 1,3, whereas in the muon neutrino electron appearance, you have all these CP violating mass hierarchy and matter effects coming in. And so these have sort of complementary information. So in terms of where things are going now, there's a new experiment studying in the US called NOVA. And so in many ways, it's a very similar experiment to TDK. The key difference is that it's, whereas TDK shoots at being 295 kilometers, here we go more than 800 kilometers. And so this matter effect is enhanced. And so they have a much better sensitivity to the mass hierarchy, this issue of whether we have normal or inverted mass hierarchy. And so if we look at where we're going with this, here's this complicated oscillation formula. We take our muon neutrino disappearance formula analysis, and we should be able to improve the precision on this. Sine squared 2 theta 2,3, we expect to be able to measure to something like 1%. Unfortunately, that turns into something like a 10% uncertainty on sine squared theta 2,3, but we'll do the best we can. Now, we have this x dependence, which is going to tell us about the mass hierarchy. And so the fact that we have two experiments with sort of minimal and more matter effects should help us trying to resolve this issue. And then finally, solar experiments have measured this theta 1,2 parameter to very high precision, and one question is whether it can be improved. But one thing is, because we have all these parameters mixed together, the precision on all the parameters actually matter in determining any of these new physics goals, whether it's the mass hierarchy, the octane issue with theta 2,3, or the CP violation. I also wanted to point out one other thing, is that you see that the CP violation term occurs as sine squared 2 theta 1,3, sine squared 2 theta 1,2, and sine squared 2 theta 2,3. So that basically tells you that if any of the mixing angles are zero, then you lose the CP violation. And that just comes back to Kobayashi Maskawa's original observation of requiring three generations. We have three generations, but if somehow the mixing angle, any of these mixing angles is zero, basically the system degenerates into two by two systems, which cannot support CP violation. And so that's why it's been very important that we, since we knew theta 1,2 was not zero and theta 2,3 is not zero, that we also see that theta 1,3 is not zero in order to have hope of seeing CP violation. I'll skip that. Now, as it turns out, in order to see CP violation, it's almost certain that our current generation of experiments are going to be insufficient. They're not going to have enough statistics. And under some lucky choices of parameters, if nature happens to choose a maximal CP violation in a certain mass hierarchy, there's a chance that we'll have a hint of it with the current generation of experiments. But it's also clear that we may need to have more data, more statistics. And so one thing that's being planned in Japan is an upgrade to Super K, this experiment called Hyper K, where it will be nearly 20 times larger, and also an upgrade to the beam power by nearly a factor of 2. And so one of the nice things about this is that in addition to all the CP violation stuff we're talking about, it's also will be one of the, it will be able to extend our reach for proton decay, which you might know to be sort of really a signature of grand unification. And so it's always been very spectacular with that within the same experiment, you can not only understand how we produce this primordial asymmetry that generated all the matter, but we might also be able to say what may happen to it all in some eons away. There's also, because it's such a large detector and it's underground, We can also do things with astrophysical neutrinos, like detect supernova neutrinos from distances as far away as the Andromeda galaxy. So even though it's really just a bigger version of Super K, it also adds some qualitatively new capabilities that you might not expect from just making the detector bigger. So I've come to the end of my talk, and so let me just come back to where we started. And so what has happened is that TDK has definitively observed muon neutrinos turning into electron neutrinos as of this summer. And that basically says that all three mixing angles in the mixing matrix for neutrinos are non-zero. And that's a necessary condition for there to be CP violation in neutrino oscillations. We don't know that there is CP violation, but we know that it is possible, at least mathematically now. And so a future experiment, or maybe if we're lucky, later within the current generations of experiments, we may see this CP violation. Now, if we find such CP violation, it may be related to the primordial matter-antimatter asymmetry of the universe through this model of leptogenesis. And that's why people are making these grandiose claims. And on the one hand, relatively speaking, it's one of the most promising candidates for why how we explain this matter-antimatter asymmetry. But you can see that there are really some weak links about how we actually connect this thing here to what we think believe happened in the early universe. So now coming back to more specifically the neutrino oscillations, we're in this era of which we all call three-flavor mixing. And now the precision on all the parameters really matters. And so we really need to nail down each of the parameters, each of the mixing angles, as precisely as possible. And so my hope is that doing that, we might be able to find some explanation, not just for these cosmological issues, but also within particle physics, this issue about why the mixing and the masses of these particles is what they are. And so this will be an important program that will involve input from many experiments. And in particular, if we're really going to relate this to leptogenesis, there is this issue about whether the neutrino is, in fact, an antiparticle, whether it's Majorana. And so these neutrinoless double beta decay experiments, which I didn't talk about, are also extremely important. And so we have a new generation of experiments like Hyper-K in Japan and LBNE in the US and LBNO in Europe. And they are proposed to measure, to look for the CP violation with extended sensitivity beyond the current capabilities, and to also extend the sensitivity to other, I think, really cool physics like proton decay and studies of astrophysical neutrinos. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have some time for questions. So this is the first colloquium of the year. In the past, what we've done is we've started with the PSI students. So are there any questions?
So you mentioned about the neutrinos double beta decay. Could you maybe explain in more detail what experiments there are to identify whether the neutrino is Majorana or Dirac masses?
What other experiments there are?
Or just in more detail what experiments are
right.
Probing this question.
So basically, the neutrino is double beta decay. Well, there's double beta decay, where basically you have a double transition, double beta transition in which you're emitting two electrons or positrons simultaneously. And so the neutrinoless double beta decay occurs when, if the neutrino is in fact its own antiparticle, basically you can close the loop which emits those two electrons and emit two electrons without also emitting the neutrinos. Basically, the neutrinos that were emitted in the double beta decay in this diagram are annihilating. And so the signature of this is that this once again becomes a kinematically constrained system. And so if you're observing double beta decay, it will have some shape. And then these events, which are kinematically constrained, should lie right at the kinematic endpoint. And so you basically can calculate where that's supposed to be. You have some kind of nucleus that can undergo this process. You get as many of these elements as you can. You try to make the energy resolution as good as you can. And you wait and hope that something happens there. That's basically the experiment. And there are several forms that I'd experiment. Experiments like SNOW Plus, where they have a large batted liquid scintillator and they embed these neutrinoless double beta decay candidates into the scintillator, and they look at the spectrum to look for these peak. They are also techniques using xenon and also germanium detectors. So there's a whole slew of different experimental techniques, but in the end, they're all looking for that sort of peak in that kinematic limit of the beta decay.
Thank you.
double beta decay.
Additional
Hi. Is there a way that you experimentally determine the distribution of the flavors in the initial beam, or is it all theoretical calculations?
Right. So I actually skipped that part. I'm sorry. So yeah, this is the near detector. And so we have a detector 280 meters from the target source. And so this detector actually has very powerful particle identification capabilities. And so these are basically showing not just how many muon neutrinos there are, but we can also divide them up into various topology depending on how many pions there are. And so in particular, we can predict separately the sort of the signal process with zero pions versus the background processes with one or more pion. That's one thing. There's also a particle identification capability. Maybe I have a backup slide on that, where we can separate the muons from electrons. And hopefully I have a picture of that somewhere. Yeah, so this illustrates how we basically separate the muons from electrons. We look at the energy ionization density of the tracks going through a certain detector, and basically we can separate these muons here from the electrons, which would appear here. And so we can actually extract the electron neutrinos themselves and measure them and compare them to what we expect. And so the rate of those interactions turn out to be right where our simulations say they should be. So that's electron neutrinos, muon neutrinos. As it turns out, we don't have to worry about the tau neutrinos because we're just below the threshold for producing tau neutrinos. Our beam is around 600 MeV, and you need to get up into sort of 2 or 3 GeV before you produce a tau neutrino. Yeah, so we do our best to try to use this near detector as much as possible to basically tell us not only the flavor of the neutrinos, but what kind of interactions are occurring and how that might reflect in the far detector.
Additional questions? OK, should we move on to the researchers then? Postdocs, faculty.
Hi, so you said this was the first definitive measurement of a neutrino oscillation in a controlled beam, basically. Back in the 90s, the LSND experiments claimed to see oscillations in the anti-neutrino sector for anti-muons. So I am guessing that you would strike the word definitive from those experiments. But the thrust of the question beyond that is really, can you carry out similar tests in the anti-neutrino sector with some measure of precision to see if antimatter has the same parameters as matter? But I'd like to hear what you think of the LSND experiments first.
Okay, so yeah, just in terms of, I'm not saying dismissing the LSND experiment necessarily. What I'm is really a question of statistical significance. The LSND effect was 3.8 sigma. We have a 7.2 or whatever, 7 point whatever sigma effect. And so, if you wanted to lower the threshold to below 4 sigma, then, yeah, for example, well, last year we saw a 3.3 sigma effect for electron neutrino appearance, and I'm saying that that's evidence, not quite definitive, and so it's just a matter of statistical significance. Likewise, the super K atmosphere data itself has something like a 3.6 sigma indication of new tau appearance within the atmospheric data, and so the definitive as opposed to everything else is just a matter of this, five sigma threshold, whatever you want to call it. Now, in terms of LSND, in terms of antineutrinos, we are planning to run the beam in antineutrinos. We can reverse the polarity of this horn and basically produce an antineutrino enhanced beam. And so, yeah, one thing we will certainly do is to look for the sort of the standard oscillations within the antineutrino sector. Now, in terms of whether we could address the LSND anomaly directly with T decay, that's a little bit challenging. Our detector is a little bit too, our near detector is a little bit too close for that. One idea that we have is that's existed for a while is that instead of having a detector at 280 meters, we can put one at 2 kilometers. And such a detector, if it were sufficient in size, it's also important to note that the oscillation probability indicated by LSND is 0.25%. So you really need to have an extremely high statistics sample and also basically a correspondingly large detector. And our detector, I think the statistics, our current near detector, I think the statistics is too low for that. But if we had a relative sort of a kiloton size detector at 2 kilometers, then we would have a sort of a second chance at exploring that, both in neutrino and anti-neutrino mode. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question. But yeah.
Okay, there's time for one more question. If not, let's thank Hiro again.